technical assistance or counties engaged in technical assistance, trying to give them best practices, talking about best practices a bunch. We're also helping them operationalize what does it mean for success. We're helping them think through a lot of these things. And then also highlighting what, not necessarily training, I don't want to call it training, but it's more like lessons learned. What are other counties doing? What are they learning? And we're trying to bring it to then other counties. So we'll have these webinars that we'll often record called Echoes. And then we try to make those available as much as possible. While we've had some attrition since July, so we started about 25 counties working with the technical assistance. Today, we're working with 15 one-on-one, but there's still 20 that's observing a lot of our Echoes that we record and then make available. So people are counties are still engaging in the technical assistance. It's gaining a fair amount of attention, but I think it could probably be utilized a little bit more.
That was Christopher Campbell, PhD, an associate professor of criminology and criminal justice at Portland State University, testifying March 7th before the Oregon Legislature's Joint Committee on Addiction and Community Safety Response at an informational hearing held by the committee as part of the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission Summit. And for now, that's it. Join us again next week for another edition of Prison Pipeline. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long.
Just as so long. Whose intentions are good. Oh, Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
I'm Naomi Klein, and you are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM.
Thank you for tuning in to KBOO Community Radio during this special programming campaign, All Thrills, No Frills, Volume 4. Now through April 15th, you will hear different marathons and series all brought to you by our talented programmers that make KBOO, KBOO. If you'd like to listen to all of the fabulous specials, go to kboo.fm/ATNF4.
This radio show contains graphic descriptions of violence, occasional use of the N-word, and other content that some people may find disturbing or offensive.
This radio show was produced at KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon.
I worked since a very young age, and I had a house that I rented when I was very young, and I had roommates move in. That was the beginning of my house being the main house where a lot of the activity happened. And the day-to-day of it was music, parties, drinking. For the most part, it was having fun.
This is John Bear. Born and raised in Portland, John describes himself as a father, a carpenter, and a community member. He lives in the same neighborhood where he grew up. In the late 80s and early 90s, John identified as an anti-racist skinhead who ran with Sharp, Skinheads Against Racial Prejudice, and then a Portland version of the Baldies. On New Year's Eve, 1992, a single incident changed the course of John's life. I'm Mike Crenshaw.
And I'm Selena Flores, your host for this episode of It Did Happen Here, the story of John Bear.
Early on, people always thought we were Nazis because we had a similar look. Sometimes we'd get attacked by people who thought we were Nazis. Ultimately, at least in my neighborhood, we formed some alliances with some of the other groups in our area, and the pressure became less. But early on, it was a lot of drama all the time.
As activists succeeded in clearing the streets and show spaces of overt neo-Nazi presence, the movement rhetoric needed to evolve beyond the simple and effective shared principle of Nazis out. But the disparate groups had no strategy for moving forward together aside from a general and fiercely held agreement that racist, homophobic, and anti-immigrant boneheads should be evicted from the city. While the Coalition for Human Dignity focused on strategies like research, community defense, and maintaining a network of information and support, Portland Sharps took it upon themselves to fight boneheads wherever, whenever. The ongoing hostilities between racists and Sharps consumed the two groups. The continual mutual harassment included frequent hit-and-run brawls and sporadic targeted threats and street altercations.
It's easy to forget how young these people were. There were kids, generally aged 18 to 22, many with abuse and trauma histories. They were basically raising each other. In the close-knit Brotherhood of Sharp, young people looking for purpose found their purpose in fighting Nazis. Anti-racist action was a broad-based political movement of punks and skins, but by 1992, the skinheads were done with politics. Jason, the ARA organizer, describes this shift.
The energy changed, and it became more sharp, very much more street-oriented. And then it became just another group of skinheads, pub, and then it was Baldies, and then it was Unity, and then it was a few other things, and then it was Intensified. And then Rose City came about. It became more of how do we get out of the political, and part of that was because the Trotskys and other factions were trying to use us to get us just to be their muscle or wield political power in their name. We were here to fight racism, homophobia, sexism. That was the focus at that point, and we did not want to lose focus of that. And so everybody was like, we're just going to fight them in the street and keep it there. So that was about the time, I want to say that when Eric Banks was shot, I think those guys were claiming Baldies at the point.
Eric Banks was a young neo-Nazi skinhead and a member of Bound for Glory, a racist white power skinhead band from St. Paul, Minnesota. Just after midnight on January 1st, 1993, Banks was shot and killed in a street altercation in southeast Portland. Here's John Bear.
On New Year's Eve, my friends and I were drinking. We were at a party. There were some Nazi groups we'd been fighting in the area regularly. People were talking to them on the phone and threats were being exchanged back and forth. And we're all drunk. That's part of the story too. So we decided we'd go out and meet them for a quote unquote fist fight. It was very snowy and icy out everywhere. We went to wherever we were going to meet them and they drove up and they pointed a gun at us out the window and we got back in the car and then they were following us. Nobody could drive fast because everyone's tires were slipping. And this is the middle of the night. So we had this weird following each other thing around the streets for a while and slipping around the corners. One of the guys I was with said, all right, I'm just going to fight the guy. And we pulled into the parking lot. He got out and they came with their car and they just ran him over. We thought he'd been run over and killed. What happened was he got pinned under the hood of the car and just slid on the ice. He wasn't even hurt very bad. The next thing I remember, there's a lot of yelling. There's a lot of screaming. People are screaming that they're shooting at us, shoot the gun. And I had a rifle with us in the car. I pointed it in their general direction and fired it a few times. At that point, my friend who I thought had been killed jumped up and got back in the car with us and we drove off.
Again, Michael Clark, an anti-racist skinhead we heard from in the last episode.
The police thought I was there. My cousin drove a car very similar to one that was there that night, and his door got kicked in New Year's Day. I got a call. What the hell did you do last night? The police just kicked in my door looking for you, blah, blah, blah. I told them I didn't know where you were, and spent the day calling around going, what the hell happened last night? I would have been there, but I was a little too high on LSD to leave the house.
John Bear describes the next morning, New Year's Day, 1993.
We all kind of split up. We did different things. I was arrested and questioned and released. And before I was released, the detectives said, you know, it's a shame that that kid lost his life out there. And I was like, oh my God. And it just hit me like a ton of bricks. But they released me and they told me that they knew who did it. They had the person locked up. The person was cooperating with them. I surmised which of my friends was locked up, and I definitely knew that he wasn't cooperating with them. And I basically had some time to think about what to do. I was 20 years old. I thought about running away, jumping on the trains and leaving town and maybe trying to alter my identity. And I tried to think about what my little brother would think, what my parents might think. And they'll definitely think that I'm guilty or that I did this thing on purpose or something like that. And ultimately, I made the decision to turn myself in. And so I did. I went and talked to the detective. I made a complete confession. For me, it was important to just tell them my part. They wanted to know what everybody else did, and I just kept it to me. And then they let me call my parents, and I called my dad. That was the toughest phone call of my life. I tried to tell him what was going on a little bit, and he was kind of confused. And then he was like, did you talk to the police? And I was like, yeah, I've been talking to them all day. He was like, oh my God, do not talk to the police. Good advice. It was a little bit late. I think I did what I needed to do to be the right thing for me. I was in jail for about 6 months before I was offered and accepted the plea bargain that I took. You know, and I spent my 20s in prison and on parole. At my pretrial, I wanted to defend why I would have ever bought a firearm or owned one. So I was in court and I was describing how we lived in this house and he'd had all these problems and everyone knew that was the Sharp house and the house had been shot up at one time, Molotov cocktails thrown at it another time. And we had a lot of noise complaints and we had a strained relationship with our neighbors and the police had been there a bunch of times. And the reason I bought the firearm was to defend my home. We were naive, but we would ham it up for these guys. We'd let them take our pictures. Of course, all this stuff was just going into files that could later be used against us. I called the officers to the stand who I dealt with in the neighborhood. There were two of them, and each of them said they'd never seen me before in their life. They had nothing on file of any incidents. That broke my heart because I realized that I was fighting a system that was corrupt. I wasn't a huge fan of police, but I still believed at age 20 that they had to follow the rules. When they got on the stand and lied to my face in front of the judge and everybody, I knew that they were going to screw me. Honestly, that's a big reason why I didn't go to trial. I pled guilty to a first-degree manslaughter. They gave me the maximum that they could give me at the time, according to the gridlock, which was 60 months. Since Measure 11, I think that changed to like 15 years of no good time. I just landed in a really unique place on the gridlock. But I recognize now as an adult, had I been a person of color or a person who didn't speak English, I don't think I would have been offered a plea bargain like that. I think it would have gone to trial and I think I would have lost. So there is that.
Racist violence still occurred in Portland after the Eric Banks killing. But by 1993, the groups of boneheads covered in hate insignia, who had for years maintained a street presence of violence and intimidation, were gone. Here's Jason and then Michael to talk about how the death of Eric Banks impacted the local landscape.
A few people got hemmed up from the cops and it didn't shut it down. It made things different and it changed the way the white supremacists went about things. Most of them believed that our side had killed one of them without hesitation. In some ways, that really worked in our favor because it quieted things down, but it changed the way they operated. And so they started moving further out. They grew out their hair. They changed the way they dressed. They went online and they started being more secretive.
I was really sad to see John go to prison for that. I think I probably helped build his mindset that made him think that was something that might need to happen. I don't think it really changed anything for anybody other than it definitely put us on the map in a different way at a different level. We have a reputation now, we have for a long time, as being somewhere that's not going to put up with your ish. So if people don't know Portland's anti-racist history, the Nazis definitely know it.
John Bear, meanwhile, embarked on his journey through the prison system.
I'm short and I'm thin. When I got to the penitentiary, I suddenly realized that, like, I didn't really know that. Oh, I'm a small guy. I was pretty intimidating. And there was about a week, I think, where people didn't know who I was. And it was pretty fine. People were friendly and I was trying to get the hang of things. And then I think the first newspaper article about my conviction came out. There were some Nazi groups where I was. They were not the majority. They immediately started giving me a hard time, harassing me, threatening me a little. The white people that I was friends with basically said, hey, you seem like a nice guy. I don't want to have the kind of problems that you have, so don't talk to me anymore. Sorry if that seems harsh, but that's the way it is. So I found myself very scared, not knowing what to do. I wanted to try to keep myself safe as best I could. I felt very alone. I got a job as a teacher's assistant for English as a second language. Ultimately, what saved me is the guys I was working with, the Hispanic community, started to wonder why I was different and why I always ate by myself and why I never went outside and I was all pale. And They were wondering if I was like a child molester or what the deal was. They learned about who I was. They basically said, look, we're going to make you an honorary Mexican. You're going to be with us now. We're going to take you under our wing, but you look terrible. Starting today, you have to go outside every day. You have to start lifting weights. They had certain ways that they did their clothes, and they brought me into their community. And honestly, it was wonderful. And we had fun, and they kept me safe, and I started getting healthy, and I started feeling better about myself. That was another real turning point for me. I would say that I had a not very good relationship with my parents at that age. And I had, you know, my own feelings about the ways in which I thought they weren't great. I thought that everything that I was doing with my friends was really great. When I went to prison, my parents came and visited me every single month for all the years that I was in, and twice on every month that there was a holiday. And they drove no matter how far it was. A lot of my friends, a lot of my brotherhood evaporated, not completely, but that was a huge wake-up call for me. My family that I thought they were so crappy, they were really there for me. And my friends who I thought were so there for me weren't present as much. And I can't put that all on everybody else because I dropped off too. I really isolated for a long time. But today I have friends that go back 20 years. I have friends that go back 30 years. This is my city. I grew up here. I've got a lot of love and support here. I was able to keep my nose clean while I was in, and eventually I earned minimum custody and I went to like a work camp where people go out on work crews and pick up litter and stuff like that. That was wonderful. That was such a different vibe. In the big penitentiary, you're housed with people who will never get out. And some of those people are crazy and some of them don't care. And so when I got to the work crews, I just felt like I could breathe a big sigh of relief. Everybody at the minimum security facilities is looking forward to going home and being reunited with their families. And I started that part of my journey. I was in Baker City, Oregon, which is very far from Portland. And my parents still kept making that trip, even when the roads were icy, no matter what. I did over 4 years, but not by very much, because I earned some good time. I got out in 97. And then after I got out, I had 5 years of post-prison supervision. And then I got out and I didn't realize how weird that would be. There's a lot of things I had to readapt to, like things that you might not ever think about. In prison, there's no darkness ever. There's always lights on. Sleeping in darkness was kind of like, whoa. You know, I got married really quickly. I had a bunch of kids. I think I was trying to be quote unquote normal. It didn't really make me normal. Today, I've been sober for 8.5 years. That's been really good for me. I have an amazing wife who is also sober with me. We're parents to 5 kids that we have part-time. Being an anti-racist skinhead isn't my whole story. You know, I'm active in the community and I work. I'm a carpenter and mostly I'm a father. Firstly, that's how I identify now. I still always had this idea that I'd be murdered. I was convinced that I'd be murdered. I carried that fear with me for a lot of years. The way I responded to that was I always thought, I want to make sure that I always tell my kids that I love them. I want to make sure that I always hug them a lot. Even though it started from the morbid motivation, I ended up having really great relationships with all my kids. I'm the parent of a trans teenage girl. That's been a really eye-opening and new experience for me. For those teenagers who are trans and are going down that road and facing all of the dangers and persecutions, like, I think they're like the bravest people. And these people come to our city to attack trans women, and to think of her getting attacked for no reason just makes me so upset. And it happens often. And it sucks. It sucks to worry about your kid's safety. It sucks to say, I want you to carry this pepper spray at all times and you need to know how to use it. You know, that sucks. That's not what I want to tell my teenager. This is not the kind of thing that I ever would have wanted to be involved in. It's just what happened. It's important to me to not regret the past or shut the door on it. And it definitely has shaped my life. I hope that sharing my experience can help others, but I also wish that that never happened. I wish I never got in the vehicle. If I could go back in time, I absolutely would do a lot of things differently. But, you know, like, we move forward from where we're at. Racists and Nazis kill people. That's not uncommon. It's just not something I ever wanted to be a part of. I wanted to stand up to the bad guys, protect the vulnerable, feel good about myself, have fun, listen to music, have friends. Those were the things I wanted to do. And when I was a kid, when I turned myself in, I honestly didn't think that I would survive my prison sentence. I just felt that's what I had to do to be right with myself. But I did. And so here we are.
That was how John Bear went through the prison system. Here's Tom, another Sharp and eventual member of the Portland chapter of the Baldies, talking about his time as an 18-year-old incarcerated person and known anti-racist.
What did you go to prison for, and how long were you in prison?
Well, there was a big protest that I think CHD organized on Hawthorne in front of a house where a lot of Nazis lived. I want to say it was like maybe 20th and Hawthorne, over by that 7-Eleven. Randy Krager, who later became the founder of Volksfront, and a bunch of other Nazis were there. We did a rally there. Later that day, we went by there. We hoped their issue. We threw shit through their windows and bricks and whatnot. And then we left. And then a few of us came back several hours later. The car got surrounded. They started blowing out our windows with sticks and stuff. Hit two of my friends. One of them had to go to the hospital because he was split from the front of his forehead to the back of his head. And then we went back and there was another thing that happened. There were two people that ended up getting hit, one with a hammer and I think maybe another one with a pipe, that filed a complaint with the police. They were both female Nazis. I don't know about the hammer. That all happened inside the 7-Eleven and I never went inside there, if that even happened. But I got pulled over driving away. I was 17. Then later on, I was arrested at the Tom Metzger trials and was subsequently charged with two counts of assault too, which after a plea bargain landed me 16 months in the state prison system. I was 17 when it happened. I was 18 by the time I was tried, convicted, and sentenced. To the best of my knowledge, I was the first anti-racist skinhead in Oregon to hit the prison system. That would have been in 1990. Within an hour of landing in Oregon State Correctional Institution, I was in the chow hall eating food. Kyle Brewster walked right up to my table and was like, "Are you Tom?" And I said, "Yep." And he said, "Get up." Those were my friends. I ended up grabbing him and people yelled cops. So we broke away. I would say within an hour, he had sent somebody into my cell, this guy named Warren, who beat me pretty good. I was blood from my head to my waistline and soaked into my jeans. So that gives you like an idea how bad this dude beat my ass. I found out later that I was on the unit that housed most of the white supremacists because it said skinhead in my file. Luckily, I was coached by my stepdad. He had done some time. And after I had a smoke, I walked out to that guy who had just beat me in cell. And when I walked out of my cell, most of the unit, they were beating on the railings, death to the sharp, death to the sharp, death to the sharp, hundreds of people. I walked over to a cell all bloody and opened up the door and I was like, "Come on out, man." And he's like, "What?" That I put my fists up and I was like, "We're going to get it. You're going to finish it right now." After a little bit of back and forth, he's like, "Look, dude, I already beat your ass." And I'm like, "Well, you're going to do it again in front of everybody else." He's like, "Nope, you got my respect. Like, you and I got no problem." Later, I was, I didn't have a change of clothes yet. I hadn't even been in prison that long. And the cops noticed I was bloody and they sent me to the hole. And then they went, "Oh, shit, we put this guy on the white power unit." And then they sent me to Eastern Oregon Correctional Institution. I know who I was when I walked into that prison. And I was determined to walk out that same person. I never denounced what I was, who I was, what I stood for. Everybody in every prison that I was at, they'd be like, "Oh, you're that Sharp." And I'm like, "Yup." There was a guy, Shamley Hazelton, that came in. He's a neo-Nazi and he was in there for stabbing a friend of mine. he walked up to me and was like, "Oh, you're that Sharp dude." And I'm like, "Yep, are we gonna have a problem?" Let's go get some. He didn't want some. Mostly, I just tried to do my own time. I know I was listening to John's episode, and it was really interesting because towards the end of my stay at Eastern Oregon Correctional Institution, which is the same prison that he was at, I had a friend that was Latino that I played Pinochle with, and he just backed me up. When Rude Brood ran up on me and I jumped up off the weight pile, and then like all these Latinos kind of came behind him and were like, "You're not doing this." That's how I got through the rest of my time, really. I can't be 100%, but I'm pretty sure that the guys that helped me out were Norteños. I don't know if I'd have made it through without those guys. Ironically, on the other side of the prison, Steve Strasser was doing his time, but we never crossed paths. Steve Strasser was the third person convicted in the Molgueta Syrah murder. That guy's been a ghost. Like, from my understanding, he did his time pretty quiet, and out of prison, he just disappeared. You know, it was about the time I got out of prison. Sharp, it kind of wasn't really a thing anymore. People were just kind of independent. Baldy's has a very early history. The original Baldy's came from Minneapolis to Portland and gave us a lot of support. There was a Portland version of that starting up. And a lot of it was, for me, it was because of the political praxis with the Baldies in the history of ARA that I felt that Sharp never had back then. For sure, they were like, most people were non-political. There was a lot of different things that weren't as analyzed through the Baldy lens. You know, you've got racism, but you also have sexism, homophobia, transphobia, all the tenets of ARA. And that made sense to me. So we started up the Baldies. I think they kind of started doing it right before I got out of prison. I got out like late 91, early 92. The Portland version of the Baldies was a thing at least through 96.
Here's a short excerpt of a bonus episode we did called More Fighters, which features Tom, who you just heard, and Jackson, Iron, and Pan. Jackson is a former Sharp, skinhead against racial prejudice, and Iron was an autistic street kid who was friends with all of the Sharps and other anti-fascist and anti-racist youth. Pan is another anti-racist skinhead, founder of the Rose City Bobber Boys. All these guys helped defend the streets and the people of Portland from racist scum. Here's Pan.
With the violence that we did as kids, we were the snowplow, and after us came the people that could actually create real change. With the Nazis that were around, nobody could do anything because they were in fear all the time. And I know that, like, when the Baldies first came out, one of the big lessons that I learned was that we don't have to apologize for, like, beating up the Nazis. We don't debate the subject. We don't go, "Well, have you ever thought about not being white pride?" No.
Here's Iron again.
If my grandchildren have to face the same things that I've faced, that you faced, that Jackson has faced, I think that everything that I pushed back against was a failure. It should end now. There's no logical reason for the things that are in place right now, the things that people didn't want to see until Trump became president, but were always there. The way that they've treated Black people, and in the past and in present and in the future, have they treated people of color, you know, with the Asian Exclusion Act. There's all these exclusion acts they talk about, but they don't really talk about all of them. You know, people from India, the men could come, but women couldn't come and stuff like that. Thankfully, now we have the Immigration Act of 1965, I think, with the momentum that came from the civil rights movement that stopped people from being able to have true exclusion acts. Although, you know, it's still there. I just don't want my great or my great great grandchildren to be dealing with the same nonsense that I'm dealing with, or you're dealing with, or anybody of color in this country is dealing with.
This is Tom again.
I'm really worried with the inauguration of Biden that more liberal-minded folks are going to be like, "We won," and just dip out. Just because the Democrats in office and Trump is gone, it doesn't mean that the fight's over. The Democrats are not the friends to the people either. we need to be mobilizing community defense for marginalized peoples that are going to be targeted by these right-wing extremists. Even if they go underground, they're not going to stop. They didn't stop last time they went underground. The researchers, you know, we need to continue that research, because that's more important than whacking somebody on the head, right? Like, the research and exposure of who these people are is what gets the job done more than anything. Dedicated anti-fascists are going to have to dig in and continue fighting.
Thanks for listening to this episode of It Did Happen Here. The transcripts, show notes with links, full credits, and other relevant content can be found at our website, itdidhappenherepodcast.com. Interviews in this episode were conducted by Mike Crenshaw and Aaron Yankee, and your hosts were Selena Flores and Mike Crenshaw. This podcast is produced by Selena, Mike, and me, Aaron Yankee. Thanks to the participants for sharing their stories. Thanks also to the Institute for Anarchist Studies, PM Press, the Marla Davis Fund, KBOO Community Radio, and the rest of our production team, Icky A., Julie Perini, and Mo Baustern. And thank you for listening.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
This radio show contains graphic descriptions of violence, occasional use of the N-word, and other content that some people may find disturbing or offensive.
This radio show was produced at KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon.
The story told backwards now is that the coalition and other groups basically ended the rise of white supremacist groups in Oregon in the 90s. That's not at all true. We were part of an effort that broke the back of the neo-Nazi skinhead youth movement, which was a particular faction of the right. But we did not end white nationalist organizing here.
That was Scott Nakagawa from the Coalition for Human Dignity. What happened to this group of scrappy activists who, for a few years in the early 90s, Portlanders saw on TV news every week fighting neo-Nazis? Where did the team of researchers stuffing filing cabinets with right-wing intelligence end up? What was their legacy? Welcome to episode 12 of It Did Happen Here, Less Booted, More Suited. I'm Selena Flores.
And I'm Mike Crenshaw. In this episode, we tell the story of the metamorphosis of the Coalition for Human Dignity. But before we get there, we need to talk about one more group, the Northwest Coalition Against Malicious Harassment, a Washington state-based anti-bigotry group. Here's Devin Burkhart.
The Northwest Coalition Against Malicious Harassment was formed a couple years before CHD. It was formed by Bill Wasmuth, a former Catholic priest from Coeur d'Alene, who participated in a lot of the early responses to the Aryan Nations. In fact, he had his house blown up by the Aryan Nations and barely survived one of their assassination attempts on them. So Bill was an ally and close supporter of CHD in the many years that he was the head of the Northwest Coalition Against Malicious Harassment. In many ways, it divided along lines that the Northwest Coalition Against Malicious Harassment was doing a lot of the organizing work. CHD was doing a lot of the research work. That was really how things were working throughout the mid-90s up until Bill ended up having to step down from his role as executive director because he had ALS. When CHD moved some of their personnel to Seattle, initially we worked out of the same offices. So we worked really closely together for a long time. Then with Bill stepping down, it felt like it was a decision to remove some of the duplication of efforts and bring both the research and organizing aspects under one roof.
Skinhead hate crimes continued through the 90s. In 1993, Portland police reported three separate attacks on two black men and an indigenous man, resulting in serious lasting injury. So it's not that violence itself disappeared from Portland, but that racist skinheads retreated from open displays of menace on the streets. Where in 1990, punks could expect to run for their lives just trying to go to a show or the corner store, by 1993, attacks became more like infrequent ambushes from a car of neo-Nazis. As for the homophobic Christian right, the Oregon Citizens Alliance petered out after leader Lon Mabon's unsuccessful run for U.S. Senate in 1996.
The Coalition for Human Dignity's migration to Seattle represented a move into a larger sphere of influence. The Northwest Coalition Against Malicious Harassment worked in a six-state region. So in 1998, the CHD relocated its entire operation up to Seattle and eventually merged with the Northwest Coalition Against Malicious Harassment.
I think once the merger happened, the organization lost its core driving force, and those external events helped make it really hard for the organization to continue as it was.
One of the external events to which Devin refers was a lawsuit centered on the militia-based Aryan Nations. In 1998, Victoria Keenan and her son were returning from a wedding near the Aryan Nations compound in rural northern Idaho when their car backfired. A compound security guard thought it was a gunshot coming from the car. He chased Keenan, shot up her car, and held the terrified mother at gunpoint in front of her son before releasing her. With the support of the Southern Poverty Law Center, Keenan sued the Aryan Nations for $6.3 million, as well as for the deed to the 20-acre compound, which bankrupted that white nationalist organization.
This gave the impression to a lot of folks that the problem of white supremacy in the Northwest was gone, that it had been, in effect, litigated away. So it was a blow to efforts to organize and to fundraise for a newly merged organization that was trying to do that kind of work, because there was no longer the same kind of urgency that groups like the Aryan Nations provided in a lot of areas around the region. They started running out of money. They also started losing interest, which meant that the large network of grassroots local community groups that they'd helped build up around the region started to slowly wither and die. At their height, they had over 125 local groups on the ground that were doing work to counter white nationalism. But a lot of those folks stopped doing it after the Aryan Nations trial. They thought that they had won, or they moved on to doing diversity work in local communities, but had given up doing a lot of the programmatic work around fighting white nationalist or militia-type activities.
Coalition for Human Dignity's researcher Jonathan Mazaki weighs in on the decision to move the organization to Seattle.
You know, I think at some point folks in the coalition wanted to take a different path. They wanted to do different stuff that perhaps didn't rely on a research-driven mechanism. We became more of a think tank. For me personally, when I was training judges and how to understand the arcane arguments of Christian patriots around the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, this was not very effective. I left in, I think, about 1998. I was always singularly focused on research and intelligence. The offices moved to Seattle. I was like, okay, go ahead, take the files. And then the folks who ran it for the couple years after that merged it with the Northwest Coalition Against Malicious Harassment. So they had cops on their boards and stuff like that. They were a more establishment kind of outfit.
Here's CHD activist Abby Layton.
People were growing up and changing. They saw other ways to do this same work in a bigger arena. What I recall at the end of Coalition for Human Dignity is that we, like every nonprofit group, we just got broke. And I don't think that was any one thing.
CHD activist M. Trelora shares some positive outcomes that showcase the distinctive character of the coalition's unique and effective methods that combine research and boots-on-the-ground mobilization to repel encroaching racists.
I think we succeeded in two ways. One, we left a little bit of a crumb trail for the future to say, okay, if you do direct confrontation, you can do open, direct confrontation of these people and win politically so that people don't leave discouraged at the end of it. The second thing was we prevented the neo-Nazi gangs and neo-Nazi formations from cohering here in Portland. And the best example of that is with the American Front, which was a San Francisco-based grouping that had a fairly dynamic leader called Bob Hike. So Bob Hike announces he's moving north to Portland to take over the neo-Nazi movement in the U.S. We had decided we would not allow any grouping to emerge. So we attacked the American Front almost from the beginning of their existence here. We went after Bob Hike. We destroyed his living situation. This is in the front page of the Oregonian. He ended up appealing to the Portland police because he said, "My house has been attacked 3 times. They've destroyed it." Yeah, the American Front fizzled out here in Portland. That was what we were looking to stop, and I think we succeeded on that limited level.
As contradictory as it sounds, the success of the Coalition for Human Dignity and other groups in eradicating the visible presence of racist skinheads played a role in the CHD's demise. With limited funds available to support leftist causes, funders directed dollars elsewhere. The single-minded focus on a specific kind of racist, the young neo-Nazi skinhead, gave the false impression that once the streets were cleared of the violent white gangs, racism was solved, and Skin City was no more.
The conversation led by city leaders, the media, and even sometimes anti-racist activists themselves promoted the idea that we had, quote, won. This seductive conclusion has had dangerous long-term consequences. CHD's research work on the white nationalists and Christian identity groups showed how they were embedded across the state. That message had little resonance on mainstream politicians, media, and the voting public.
Breaking the back of the skinhead youth movement was a huge accomplishment for Portland, but CHD research always showed a more complex story. One of a guy at a feed store who stockpiles guns and distributes propaganda on Jewish control of the media. A doctor at a clinic who informs immigration services on a patient in crisis. Parents who homeschool kids in order to provide a curated history recasting white Christians as an oppressed group.
Once the neo-Nazis were driven out of Portland, where did they go? Stephen Gardner, a coalition writer, researcher, and organizer, elaborates on the evolution of white nationalists.
So this older generation of neo-Nazi and white nationalists who emerged and set an ideological agenda that was, as they said at the time, less booted, more suited. And so it was more about what's a strategy for capturing public policy. They strategically came to understand immigration as the single biggest threat to white identity. This doesn't mean that they don't continue to be anti-queer, anti-black, and so on. They are. It's just step back from that and focus on immigration. And now, of course, they have people who are only one person removed from white nationalist thought leaders who are setting the immigration policy of the United States.
Again, Scott Nakagawa.
White nationalist organizing here continued. It's continuing now. You know, the bombing of the Oklahoma City Federal Building, the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City occurred. That bombing caused so much carnage, so much damage. Children died. There was a childcare facility within the building. You know, hundreds of people were affected. Finally got the federal government to put white nationalist groups and Christian patriot groups in particular at the top of their FBI watch list. So it forced the movement underground, but they continued organizing there. During the Obama years, people were making the claim that we were post-racial. The right merely consolidated and expanded underground, and Obama was like a shot of adrenaline in the arm of the Islamophobic faction of the right. So those organizations grew in number and in support until the Trump election, when his ascendancy basically turned on the green light. A movement that had gone underground and become alienated from mainstream politics decided to step out into the light of day and begin organizing and vying for power because they believed their time had come and that the Trump election was an indication of it.
In these times of right-wing fascist influence within the legislative and political chambers locally and nationally, the CHD provides inspiration for effective anti-racist community organizing, but it's important to remember that it was a group that formed within a specific landscape in response to historical events of the 80s and 90s. This is Eric Ward.
We look to the Coalition for Human Dignity for a lot of direction. They certainly sparked our creativity. And I think Coalition for Human Dignity helped shape our understanding of what it really meant to take on white nationalism. We also had to understand that hate groups didn't come to town bringing racism or anti-Semitism, homophobia, or other forms of bigotry to our community. These hate groups simply organized the bigotry that already existed.
It can be hard to remember how much things have changed in a relatively short time. The Coalition for Human Dignity was organizing before hate crimes against LGBTQ people were routinely prosecuted as criminal acts, during a time when discrimination based on sexual orientation was the law of the land. Before the Americans with Disabilities Act, just to name a few landmark civil rights, which are now established and protected by federal legislation. Chronic urgency permeated CHD day-to-day activities. Regular death threats and violent confrontations overshadowed group process and undermined the essential work of creating equitable conditions within their organizing efforts. The CHD existed inside the patriarchy it was trying to combat. Like other leftist groups of 30 years ago, it often fell short of professed ideals, especially in leadership representation. Looking back, we hear some of the external shortcomings of the CHD, but it's just as important to acknowledge the internal culture. This is CHD activist Krista.
Because I'm somebody who also is really focused on process and on spaces being inclusive, as I became more involved with Coalition for Human Dignity, who at the time were doing some really valuable work researching the nitty-gritty of the rise of neo-Nazis in the Northwest. There were a few individuals putting a lot of time into working, connect more deeply in the punk music scene and work with folks in anti-racist action and sharp skinheads against racial prejudice and make sure that we were understanding both the movement we were working against and the different aspects of resistance in primarily white communities. I mean, I'll say that I think at that time, Black United Front and Urban League and a lot of folks were really leading those struggles in other spaces, and Coalition for Human Dignity, say more of an ally organization. My role in that ally organization in part was to point out the importance of us not recreating some of the dynamics that give rise to bias and leave folks out. I came to that work as a young feminist, so was often the person to say, wow, this meeting has not really had a lot of female voices happening. Not to not give full credit to the fact that there were several men who really helped found the organization, worked hard, brought lots of experience to it, and yet it was hard for women to move beyond being the photocopying committee. Some of my work was really about trying to remind those of us doing the work that by creating more space, and sometimes that meant stepping back to create more space, we'd actually have more power.
Here's Intralore again.
Here's a failure on our part. The Lesbian Community Project, a couple members of that grouping started the homophobic violence reporting line. This was before hate crimes existed as a federal thing and before anybody was tracking them. And while the OCA was doing its organizing, those incidents spiked, I mean, dramatically. Unfortunately, a member of the community here in Portland decided to start faking hate crime incidents. We have to then and now be open to the fact that we're going to be misled by some people. She had an elaborate ruse set up. When that came forth, dozens, if not hundreds of people basically washed their hands of political work and organizing for a while. She'd appealed to us for help. Two of our organizers, Pat and Cecil, had gone and investigated, and they came back and said, this isn't real. The error on our part was we did not tell everybody else. For that, I apologize then, I apologize now. When you make certain political mistakes, you have to own up to them. Otherwise, people are going to say, well, I'm not going to have anything to do with this in the future.
Again, Scott Nakagawa.
Those of us who are able to take action need to do so and need to do so assertively and boldly. Mm-hmm. And we need to do it in public. Change comes about not as a result of doing the easy things like sending an email or taking a picture. They result from doing the hard things. The CHD did that kind of work of forcing people to do something different. We attacked the cultural landscape and knew that whoever owns it owns a very important tool to define ideology at that time. And we put up posters, we spray painted out Nazi graffiti, we put on concerts, we did things like that that would interrupt the life of the alternative music scene and the life of young people in the city of Portland. We were assertive about it. We were in the media. We were in the news cycle practically every week. The story about the fight against white supremacy in the state of Oregon was listed among the top two stories of the 20th century by the Oregonian by the time groups like the CHD were done. We put the story in your face and we forced people to have to deal with it. We took young people and marched them up and down the bus walls downtown Portland in protest to neo-Nazis so that people would begin to see that this was a real problem. They could not just go to work. We were in their faces. And so that kind of thing, I think, really makes a difference. I also used to be a member of ACT UP. ACT UP activists put their lives on the line. They put their bodies on the line in order to make the case that something needed to be done about the AIDS crisis. If it were not for ACT UP, I do not honestly believe we would have made the kind of progress we finally were able to make under the Reagan administration, the Bush administration, to do something, to make some funding available to start to deal with prevention and treatment of HIV and AIDS. These kinds of things happen because people didn't just take a picture or send an email. It happened because they took an action and they worked with people one-on-one in person and mobilized people in groups in order to really change the way that people are going to experience their day-to-day lives.
Former SHARP member Pete Little offers a hindsight perspective of the importance of the Coalition for Human Dignity.
The significance of CHD and ARA is I actually think that the best of those is there were a lot of political radical veterans in there, and they played a significant role both in providing the important social base outside of the subcultures to sustain, support, defend the young militants, and as well, significant elements of them actually did a good job in helping to cultivate a level of political understanding, consciousness, and awareness that would allow that militants to be utilized in more thoughtful and productive ways. So I would say that the dominant subcultural tendency within the scene at that time was very anti-political. Like, we don't get involved in politics. We hate Nazis, but the political stuff, that's its own thing. I think at the same time, it's important to acknowledge that CHD and the folks around it were really important in being a people who'd been through previous epics of struggle, who could hopefully cultivate deeper awareness and thoughtfulness and strategy to young folks who were just passionately throwing themselves against this new thing that was reemerging.
Devin Burghardt started as an intern at the CHD and is now the president of the think tank watchdog group Institute for Research and Education on Human Rights.
CHD played an integral role in the larger community of anti-fascists. I mean, I can't even count how many people that are still doing this work today either worked at CHD or had contact with CHD. So it really was a magical place in providing that inspiration and the kind of spark that allowed people to continue doing this work over the long haul. That's something that not a lot of organizations can tout, and I'm really proud to have played as small a part as I did of that.
Again, Abby Layton.
They stood up for me. They stood up for my daughter. They stood up for Mary Steiger, the old woman who opened her house. They held me when I cried. They gave me information. They taught me how to take a stand and how to be brave. And, you know, I still feel so impassioned about the work, about life in general, and about the gift of meeting them when I did.
Jonathan Mazzocchi looks back into the future of research-driven community defense.
For a few years, we've got some pretty decent funding, so it allowed us to hire a few staffers. Never a great number, but a few, three, four people, if not full-time, then part-time. And again, back then, when you're maintaining a clipping service and maintaining files, and you've got to, oh God, write grants, you know, you've got to do applications to foundations to get money, this is really time-consuming and takes away from your organizing, frankly. And a great deal of it is, I don't know what the situation is today, but I can guess. Many NGOs, many Fight the Right groups are probably stuck in the same difficult position where you're having to justify your existence and justify your work to funders who are philanthropists. So skip forward to today. I don't think you need an office to do this anymore. The Antifa and other anti-fascist groups understand that. They're right. So what that also means is that you don't necessarily need a foundation-driven approach to this. And maybe we're better off not having foundations involved in this directly, and that perhaps there's a new model.
How do the former coalition activists view the landscape today? Here's Gillian.
Back then, it felt like things were going in a bad direction, and fear of all of the things that were happening. But it just felt like we could turn the tide. We would turn the tide. Right now, it just feels like there's such a global shift, and that global shift is reaching the upper echelons of power. It feels much more terrifying to me. All of the things that we were doing then and that we had success with and coming at it from different angles, to me, it felt possible to create the change that we were looking for. There's something that's happening now that is way beyond us taking action in the streets that has something to do with internet and propaganda and fake news. It's hard to figure out how to combat it. Our tactics that we used feel small and inadequate. Maybe necessary, but not adequate to the task.
It's very important to see these movements as woven into the society. Like, they're not separate things. What we're seeing now is this kind of exuberant white supremacy. David Duke is overjoyed right now. They finally have someone in the White House that actually supports them. So that's the difference I see. This is woven into the society, is we never can get it to go away. You can't unweave it.
That was Abby Layton, and here's Stephen Gardner.
The work continues to be urgent today. It's everyone's problem to the extent that we care about the kind of society that we live in and recognize that there are large-scale trends that are pushing the politics, making it more vibrant on the far right, and those are demography, the ways in which the demographics of the United States are changing. Those are migration that is going to be driven increasingly by climate change, and militarization and authoritarianism, which are the typical responses of states when they feel their legitimacy is being challenged, including by right-wing, far-right movements that are responding to the climate change, migration, and identity threat as they perceive it. So I anticipate from the state increasing moves towards authoritarianism in the name of fighting, quote-unquote, Nazis. And in fact, historically, those state resources have usually been used much more broadly and much more intensely against communities of color than the left.
Again, this is Eric Ward.
I would just offer this humble wisdom, be taken or ignored, right? We didn't build political power. We didn't consistently build a constituency that would allow movements against bigotry to challenge policies and rules that create space for organized bigotry. Who holds positions of power in our community really do matter in these moments of crisis. The second lesson is around subculture. Many of us came out of subculture. So when we created an anti-bigotry movement, of course, that anti-bigotry movement resembled a subculture. Subcultures are not effective in this period. This is a moment where white nationalism is on the rise. It has not peaked yet. They are dependent on mass base. We have to respond in scale as well. We need more people involved. And subcultures are not good containers for mass-based organizing. It is our role to challenge and to influence Portland's culture, not just our own political subculture in this moment. The third is this: find joy in resistance. That it is so important that we not replicate the toxic masculinity that we are experiencing from white nationalists and the alt-right. And so I really am just thankful for the women, non-binary leaders out there. We can effectively respond to toxic masculinity through joy, through celebration.
Thanks for listening to this episode of It Did Happen Here. The transcripts, show notes with links, full credits, and other relevant content can be found at our website, itdidhappenherepodcast.com. Interviews in this episode were conducted by Annette Newell, Selena Flores, Ender Black, and Aaron Yankee. And your hosts were Selena Flores and Mike Crenshaw. This podcast is produced by Selena, Mike, and me, Aaron Yankee. Thanks to the participants for sharing their stories. Thanks also to the Institute for Anarchist Studies, to PM Press, to the Marla Davis Fund, to KABU Community Radio, and to the rest of our production team, Icky A., Julie Perini, and Mo Baustern. And thank you for listening.
KABU.
Tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Thank you for tuning in to KABU Community Radio during this special programming campaign, All Thrills, No Frills, Volume 4. Now through April 15th, you will hear different marathons and series, all